The novelist Colson Whitehead won a following with stories that explore a world that's both familiar and a little skewed, or a lot. Consider the man at the center of Whitehead's new book, Zone One.
It's about a guy just trying to make it to the next day without being killed. So it's about New Yorkers.
People in New York City of the near future. It's been devastated. A mysterious plague has swept the world, turning billions of people into zombies who walk around seeking nothing except to bite and infect other people. Zone One is the story of the human survivors who were clearing the undead from Lower Manhattan. They bag and remove the zombies, which they call skells, hoping the island can be re-inhabited. Colson Whitehead began talking with us about this book in an extended interview on Twitter some days ago, and now we continue on the radio.
The plague that's ruined the world is in remission, and we're trying to rebuild society. So our main character, Mark Spitz, is part of a team who's working downtown New York, trying to clear out the angry remaining dead from buildings. They go door to door. And Mark Spitz is trying to find his way to the next human settlement.
What made you want to destroy New York City, of all places?
New York is always destroyed. I mean, I think Giuliani, Bloomberg, they got rid of the old New York. I think each time you destroy a tenement and put up a luxury tower, you're ruining New York and making some sort of a new version of the city. And I'm walking around with my idea of what New York was 30 years ago, 20 years ago. So is everybody else. And we superimpose that ruined city over what's here now. So it's cleaned up, but we're still seeing that old shoe store, dry cleaners, that old apartment where we used to live. So any street you walk down in New York is a heap of rubble because that's sort of how we see it if we've been here a while. Mm-hmm. So it was about time for me, artistically, to take a stab at my hometown.
And that's a nice metaphor for wiping out the entire population.
Certainly. I wanted to, to cut back on the Whole Foods lines and make it easier to get a cab for my main characters. So if you get rid of 90% of the population, life gets a bit easier in the city.
Now and again, you have a description of a zombie walking through the streets of New York City, wearing his old pinstripe suit, wearing his old clothes, and it makes you think of some guy who's lost his job, who's wandering around, sitting on a park bench.
I can read that part. It's right in front of me. In this section, Omega Team, Mark Spitz is on this team of sweepers, sweeping building to building, and they're having a conference in Tribeca, and they see something coming down the street. The skell wore a morose and deeply stained pinstripe suit with a solid crimson tie and dark brown tasseled loafers. A casualty, Mark Spitz thought. It was no longer a skell, but a version of something that predated the anguishes. Now it was one of those laid-off or ruined businessmen who pretend to go to the office for the family's sake, spending all day on a park bench with missing slats to feed the pigeons bagel bits, his briefcase full of empty potato chip bags and flyers for massage parlors.
That does feel like current events to me.
Yeah, whether you're a zombie or a survivor, you're pretty much in Zone One. You're going through your remembered motions. You're a ghost haunting your former life.
Did you hesitate to put out a book about zombies? Because I feel like you're trying to tell me something serious here. I really get that. But some people might not take you seriously because, well, it's a book about zombies.
Well, for me, I wrote a book about elevator inspectors. And when I was writing it, I would tell my friends and they'd say, "What are you doing? You're an idiot." And I would say, "Yes, I am. But this is what I have to do. I didn't really have much of a choice." And I did have to give myself permission because zombies are so popular. But I think the idea is that if it's good, people read it. And so all I could do is really just salute my childhood influences and try to do the best I could in reinvigorating the genre or putting a new spin on it.
Had you grown up with apocalyptic stories, apocalyptic films, zombie films?
Well, I mean, I grew up in New York in the 70s, and so I took films like The Warriors and Escape from New York as documentaries. Other kids did sports. I like to hang around watching The Twilight Zone and various movies about the end of the world, whether it was Planet of the Apes, A Damnation Alley. And so that's part of the city I carry with me from my childhood. And partially in doing this book, I was trying to pay homage to certain cinematic depictions of a ruined New York.
What makes an apocalyptic story succeed as opposed to one that is forgotten?
There has to be some glimmer of hope. that refuge, whether it's mythological or real, that keeps people going. You pile on the misery, and certainly I devised certain mishaps. I guess, frankly, I killed off a lot of my characters and did bad things to them. But there has to be some idea that you can get to a place where you can put the plague, the atomic bomb, the asteroid behind you, and make a new life for yourself with the other survivors.
You told us in this Twitter interview that we did that you were in a bad mood most of the time you were writing this.
I think it helped. You know, I have an idea of how I, you know, construct work, how I make characters, situations. And then there's that hidden current of what's actually going on in your life and how it's being expressed or is kind of submerged in the writing. So, you know, over the course of 2 years, you have your own ups and downs. And I think navigating my own personal catastrophes, I think, helped the book in a certain sort of way, if that's vague enough.
Well, I was going to ask, actually, to the extent you're comfortable sharing, what personal catastrophes?
Yes, certain life changes. My father died a few months before I started the book.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Got divorced. And I think there's something about finding the next place of safety, which I think fed the book in a bit.
So have you worked out now your youthful obsession with zombies and the apocalypse and so forth?
Well, I mean, that was part of the hope. You know, some kids, some grown-ups have anxiety dreams about talking in front of a group of people and they're naked, or they've forgotten all the materials for their presentation and they're unprepared. I've always had zombie anxiety dreams ever since, you know, seeing Dawn of the Dead when I was in junior high. So once a month I have some zombie dream. They're fast, they're slow. Sometimes they talk. Sometimes I'm alone. And I was definitely hoping that I would end this particular manifestation of anxiety dream by writing the book. And I was 95% successful. I had one a couple of days ago. Perhaps that's tied to publication.
Oh.
I'm not sure.
Oh. Or maybe the Twitter interview we were doing at the time may have prompted.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Colson Whitehead, congratulations on the book. It's called Zone One.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And you can read our complete annotated Twitter interview with Colson Whitehead. It lives online. There's a link at npr.org and also on Twitter at @NPRInskeep.
This month, the redesigned Toyota Camry hits showrooms. It's been America's best-selling car for 9 years. But Toyota has lost market share, suffered from bad publicity, and then there was the Japanese earthquake. So, as NPR's Sonara Glinton reports, for Toyota, the success of the new Camry is crucial.
The new Toyota Camry is so important to Toyota and the industry, I wanted to test one out and get the opinion of any number of experts. So first thing, I rolled up to a valet stand in Dearborn, Michigan. That's where I met Ali Nimi. He's a hotel valet.
It's a lot more sharper than the older model. You know, it's a lot more aggressive. Stands a lot nicer, and it's a lot more sportier.
You drive a lot of cars, huh?
We drive plenty of cars, and this is actually one of the nicer ones, considering it's a Toyota and it's affordable.
Nimi joked he'd consider buying one, but first he'd have to move from Dearborn, Michigan. The new Toyota Camry looks lower to the ground and is less rounded and has slightly more masculine styling. Here's the thing. Still looks like a Toyota Camry. Jeff Wardle teaches car design at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. He says it's much harder designing a Toyota Camry than, say, a Ferrari. By a lot.
You're looking at small improvements in many, many areas, trying to get a little bit more headroom, a little bit more legroom, trying to make the vehicle get better fuel consumption, and at the same time be very, very aware of what your competitors are doing.
Wardle says Toyota is constantly tweaking and retweaking the Camry. It's Toyota's crown jewel, and he says Toyota cannot get it wrong.
They have to tread this really fine line between making the car more attractive, more desirable, more usable for their intended audience. They've got to get it just right so they don't take too many risks, but it can't be a mediocre vehicle either.
If there's a person who knows how tough it's been for Toyota, it's Bob Carter.
This has been a tough last 3 years in this economy for all industries.
Carter's been with the company for 30 years. Now he heads the Toyota brand in North America. He's been the one to steer the brand during some of the roughest times. Carter says the company has to focus on the cars the consumers want to buy.
Well, Camry is the number one seller in the U.S. Camry is our number one volume vehicle, so it's critically important. But consumer tastes evolve over time.
Now, baby boomers have always been kind of taken with the Camry. That's not necessarily true of Gen Xers or millennials. Carter says he believes the Camry will eventually lose its crown as America's top car, but he says he's working to make sure the next one is a Toyota. The company will introduce or completely overhaul more than 20 vehicles in the next 34 months.
Yes, so this will be my first unveiling. So,
Rebecca Lindland is an analyst with IHS Automotive. In the parking lot of an industry conference, I took her for her first viewing of the new Camry. Now, let me pause here for a moment to say that when Toyota loaned me the new Camry for a test drive, they made sure it was in my favorite color, red, and the radio was tuned to NPR. Okay, back to Rebecca Lindley.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's keep walking around it. The Camry buyer is an appliance buyer. God love them, but they are appliance buyers. They're not as interested in making a statement, you know, on the roads.
Lindland says the conservative redesign of the Camry will be very reassuring to existing Toyota owners. The question is whether the Camry can lure new buyers to the brand, because that, she says, is what Toyota needs. Sonara Glenton, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Another dietary trend that's exploded in recent years is gluten-free products. You can now get everything from cupcakes to brownies to pizza with a gluten-free label. NPR's Allison Aubrey looks at whether there's any real health benefit for people who don't have celiac disease. And that's the condition where people can't tolerate gluten.
There was a time, not too many years ago, before gluten-free was a $2.6 billion a year business, when wheat-free alternatives sat in a lonely corner of the health food store. Now, when you walk through a market, you can be inundated with options.
Our seafood refresco is gluten-free. Our dips are all gluten-free. We make gluten-free crab cakes.
Chris Hoagie has a booth at the Penn Quarter Fresh Farm Market in D.C. Market director Ann Yonkers says many more vendors are following suit.
We've just had a lot more interest from bakers who are getting more sophisticated in terms of baking things that are gluten-free, that are delicious.
So why are so many people going out of their way to avoid gluten? Well, some of them have celiac disease. Their bodies can't handle gluten, which is a protein found in wheat and other grains. It makes them sick. Now, researchers estimate that fewer than 1% of Americans have this disease. And Fresh Market shopper Elizabeth Malone is not among them. But she's chosen to go gluten-free anyway, and she says she feels better.
I find that I'm a lot healthier because of it. You know, we don't eat any processed food anymore. You can't call Domino's and order a pizza. It's just a much healthier way of being in a lot of ways.
Elizabeth started eating gluten-free because of her husband. She says he's got a wheat intolerance. Now, experts in the medical community used to poo-poo the idea of wheat sensitivities. Some doctors thought if you didn't have celiac disease, any bad reaction to wheat was just in your imagination. But Dan Leffler, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard, says this is changing.
There's been a number of studies over the last couple years, a small number but convincingly done, that show that there really is a phenomenon of what's now known as non-celiac gluten sensitivity. These are people who clearly don't have celiac disease, but at the same time do have symptoms when they're exposed to gluten.
Symptoms such as bloating, gas, and other GI problems. Leffler says it's impossible to put a number on exactly how many people have some degree of gluten sensitivity. But he says it's likely that some portion of the millions of people diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome don't tolerate gluten well.
Gluten is a very difficult protein to digest. It doesn't get broken down in the way many other proteins or sugars do.
And for some people, that means the work of breaking it down is pretty much left up to the bacteria in the gut.
And when that happens, the bacteria create gas and acid, and at least a fair proportion of people, it's those byproducts of bacterial digestion of gluten that's causing symptoms.
There are plenty of people out there who tolerate gluten just fine. But a recent survey by the market research firm Packaged Facts finds some of them have other motivations for buying gluten-free foods. Joel Wardy works for a company called Enjoy Life Foods. They make lots of gluten-free sweets. He says people often think they're healthier.
Because it's called gluten-free, people assume gluten must be bad, because why else would you want gluten-free?
And some people think it'll help them shed a few pounds. They figure if they're giving up wheat, then they're giving up carbs. And hey, that's got to be good for the waistline. But here's why this thinking does not work. There are too many delicious gluten-free goodies out there, like this one.
So we're going to let you taste a chocolate chip cookie, and you're going to tell me whether or not you don't think it tastes like the best chocolate chip cookie you've ever had.
It's chocolate, so of course it tastes good. Harvard's Dan Leffler says his research shows that a lot of people actually gain weight on a gluten-free diet. He says, by all means, try a gluten-free diet if you think your body doesn't handle it well. But don't be fooled into thinking that it's somehow healthier for everyone. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Last week, officials in the southwest metropolis of Chongqing forced Walmart to shut down all 13 of its stores in that city as punishment for mislabeling pork as organic. More than 25 people have been detained in connection with the pork labeling incident. Today's announcement also comes after two other high-level resignations from Walmart's China team. Earlier this year, the company's chief financial officer and chief operating officer for the country also stepped down.
Cleanup is underway in cities around the world after a weekend of protests. Tens of thousands of people turned out. They protested greedy bankers, inept politicians, government austerity, the growing gap between rich and poor, and above all, the system that runs the global economy. There was some violence in Rome, dozens of arrests. Other places were more peaceful. And in London on this Monday, the protests are still going on. So let's talk about that and more with NPR's Philip Reeves, who's on the line. Hi, Philip.
Hi.
What have you seen in London today?
Well, it's a rather remarkable scene, really, Steve. I mean, everyone knows St. Paul's Cathedral, that great domed church right in the heart of London, built by Christopher Wren after the Great Fire of London in the 17th century. Now, that stands right next to the financial district. And remember, London is one of the world's biggest and most powerful financial capitals. And this morning, the people going to work there found themselves walking past dozens of little igloo tents, which have been pitched right outside the cathedral. Testimony that the Occupy Wall Street movement and also Spain's Indignado mass protest movement have come to London.
So who's protesting?
Well, they tend to be young. They are not surprisingly young, I suppose, as latest figures reveal that 21% of the 16 to 14-year-olds in the UK are now unemployed. But they're not all British either. I was talking to them over the weekend, and there was a much bigger crowd, about 2,000 to 3,000 people, and there were middle-class Europeans there from continental Europe. Among them, for example, a guy called Gonzalo Fernandez. He's an architect. He's highly educated. He's 33 years old. He's having to work in Britain. He says, although the economy in Britain's bad and unemployment's rising, because the situation is a lot worse in Spain.
It's impossible to get back now to Spain, even if I wanted, which actually I do. There's no jobs there.
What do you blame for this overall situation?
Capitalism is the responsible. Definitely, it's a not sustainable system from any point of view, from an economical point of view, from a social point of view, from an environmental point of view.
Fernandez's views summed up, Steve, the view of many I spoke to outside St. Paul's.
Philip Reeves in London, I'm sure it's not entirely coincidental that these protests would be timed on the same weekend as a meeting of the world's largest economies, or leaders of the world's largest economies, the G20 in Paris. What were they saying there?
Well, yes, this was a meeting of finance ministers and central bankers, and I think their message can be boiled down to a pretty simple one, and it's a message to the Eurozone leaders, and it is get your act together. They want urgent action. Everyone's worried about a global recession. For a long time, Europe's leaders have been accused of dithering and bickering. So the G20 is really piling on the pressure. They want a comprehensive plan to solve this thing, and they want it soon, before October the 23rd. That's less than a week away, Steve.
Why
so
then?
The pace of this thing is really picking up, finally.
Why then, October 23rd?
Well, that's when there's going to be a summit of the European Union, and that is it's next Sunday, and it's considered critical. All eyes are on the Eurozone's two big players, France and Germany. They've been working for quite a while now on a plan to end the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis. Very briefly, well, very sort of put very simply, the idea is to create a massive firewall that will protect other countries like Spain and Italy from being infected by the crisis that we've been reporting on for a long time now in Greece, and spreading, by the way, even beyond that to the US and the entire global economy. Among the components are an agreement on the losses that the private sector should take on Greek debt, a credible plan for recapitalizing Europe's banks. These need to be strengthened, notably in France, and also how to use the beefed up Euro bailout fund and whether to beef it up still further by a lot more.
In just a few seconds, Philip Reeves, given the political difficulty these countries have had agreeing on anything, can they really figure this out in less than a week?
Pretty difficult. France and Germany have disagreements. They're going to need to get this thing done. Details are expected by Thursday, but it'll have to be a plan that convinces the markets that it's actually workable, it's going to be effective, and that is a tall order.
Phil, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves in London.
Staying in New York State now, on Long Island, investigators are widening their probe of SAT cheating rings. They've already arrested 6 students. Authorities say those students paid thousands of dollars to have an impersonator take the SAT for them. More arrests are pending. And as Charles Lane of member station WSHU reports, the students aren't the only ones facing hard questions. Investigators are also questioning the company that oversees the SAT.
This part of Long Island is known as the Gold Coast. It's a 20-minute train ride from Manhattan, where Heather Lieber studies at the Fashion Institute of Technology. For former schoolmates at Great Neck North High School are accused of hiring people to take their SAT. To Lieber and others here, money and pressure to get into top colleges created the atmosphere for cheating.
That is something in especially this Great Neck community. They're expected to continue to get the wealth that they grew up with.
Prosecutors allege that a loose network of kids created a market of different test takers to forge school IDs, go to testing sites outside of Great Neck where they wouldn't be recognized by proctors, and score well for other students. Nassau County District Attorney Kathleen Rice says 19-year-old Samuel Ezegoff got up to $2,000 to score in the test's top 3%. Towards the end, Ezegoff started to get bold.
So he actually showed up at one of the off-site test sites and impersonated a girl. And was able to do that without a proctor noticing.
Ezegoff is pleading not guilty and contends criminal charges are inappropriate. Rice says the cheating went on for a year before school administrators heard rumors and started comparing GPAs to test scores. After handwriting samples suggested one person took a number of tests, they brought the information to Rice.
This is not an isolated incident. So our investigation is continuing, and it's my belief that we are going to show that this was far more systemic.
But administrators of the SAT disagree.
Cases of impersonation are so rare as to be unique.
Tom Ewing is spokesman for Educational Testing Services, the nonprofit that administers the SAT. He's been working hard to downplay impersonations as rare. Local and private investigators doubt this claim, but still, Ewing calls the SAT security world class.
That's able to detect as many test security issues as possible without putting undue burden on 99.9% of students who test honestly.
It's another nonprofit, the College Board, that actually owns the SAT. It's an association of 5,000 colleges and universities that contract ETS to administer, score, and secure the SAT's integrity. A simple way to halt impersonators is to photograph and fingerprint the student who actually shows up to take the test. ETS does this for one of its tests, the TOEFL, but doesn't for the SAT because the College Board wants the test to be as burden-free as possible for test takers. A walk through Great Neck Shopping District reveals a range of emotions over the cheating scandal. Embarrassment that the community's elite image has taken a ding, and anger at the national scrutiny. Alexander Rosenberg had class with several of the accused students.
It's really unfair to the rest of us that others just paid their way for a good grade, while the rest of us had to go to all these classes and study.
Prosecutors say the SATs are a long way from being secure and have subpoenaed records to find out how ETS investigates cheating. The College Board is also reviewing ETS procedures and plans to testify before a hearing in New York later this month. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The world of IndyCar racing has lost one of its stars. Two-time Indianapolis 500 winner Dan Weldon was killed yesterday during an IndyCar race in Las Vegas. Weldon was trailing a pack of cars when he was unable to avoid a massive pileup.
Here we go.
Trouble contact and a huge crash. Up in turn number two. Multiple cars involved.
Many drivers said it was one of the worst crashes they'd ever seen. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter joins us now with more about Dan Weldon. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, describe what happened in this race.
Weldon was starting from the back of the field. He was trying to get through the pack of cars in front of him. It was designed in this race for people to be very close together. They wanted to have some exciting passing back and forth. Because of that, the cars were very close to one another, and it's not a huge track. It's not like the size of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which would be 2.5 miles around. Yet they were going about the same speeds. They were approaching 220 plus miles per hour. Going that fast, no normal human really has the reaction time to avoid anything if it happens in front of you. And sadly enough, that was what happened. A couple of cars got into each other. There were spin-outs. There were wrecks. Cars were flying. And Weldon hit the ensuing chaos. His car flew up into the air. It flew above the actual wall itself into the fencing that is above the wall and unfortunately suffered injuries that were life-taking.
Were there earlier concerns that this kind of accident could happen?
There were. Drivers brought that up before the race, actually. On these smaller tracks, you typically wouldn't have this type of speed, number one. And number two, you wouldn't have this massive amount of cars on it. However, the IndyCar series itself has struggled a bit in popularity. And they have been trying to do things that would try to revive the sport. And one of them was they were pointing to this last race. This was the very last race of the season. They wanted to make it a real spectacle. And because of that, they wanted to have the exciting passing back and forth and cars darting and dodging. And they were worried, the drivers were, that if anything did happen, they'd be so closely packed together that they would be unable to avoid any kind of a catastrophe.
Now, you spoke with Dan Weldon any number of times, so you knew him a bit. What was he like?
Very personable, a charmer, always a bright smile, always somebody who was thrilled with the sport of auto racing itself. He was a racer in the truest sense because that was what really brought him joy. Other than his family. He would always have a happy word for people. You know, I mean, sometimes they'll make a saint out of somebody in this kind of a situation, but you don't have to go too far with Weldon. The strange thing about it was he was twice the winner of the Indianapolis 500, the marquee event in this series, and yet he hadn't been able to get with a full-time team for this season. He'd only had done a few of the races of the dozen and a half or so that they did during the entire year. And so even in between, he was racing go-karts and things where he wasn't making any money, but was just doing it for the love of the sport. It's something where everyone in the pit lane, when this happened, was crying. They were praying during the couple of hours that the race itself was stopped before it was announced that Weldon had passed. And everyone is truly sad. It's a loss of a great driver and somebody who, by all accounts, was a pretty darn good human being.
Quinn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter.